Imagine realizing that the peace in your own home isn't natural. Like it's something you have to actively, exhaustingly engineer every single minute of every single day.
Right. It's not just a given.
Exactly. I mean, for most of us, family dynamics are they're kind of like a mobile hanging over a crib. You bump it, the whole thing wobbles for a second, but eventually it settles back into this perfect, quiet equilibrium.
Yeah, gravity just does the work for you.
But for families raising an autistic child, balance isn't a given at all. It is a really hard-won victory. So, welcome to today's deep dive. I am so glad you're here with us. We're going to explore a really comprehensive guide from AngelSense, and it's titled Supporting Siblings of Autistic Children: Tips for a Balanced Family.
It is such a vital piece of the puzzle, and honestly, it often gets completely overshadowed.
It really does.
Because, you know, when a family gets an autism diagnosis, the immediate focus obviously rushes toward the autistic child. You've got the therapies, the safety plans, the school accommodations.
And the immediate emergencies, right?
Exactly. But this guide, it kind of forces us to widen the lens and look at the collateral impact on the rest of the house.
And the mission of our deep dive today is to explore those hidden dynamics. Specifically, we want to look at how to support the non-autistic siblings and make sure that every single child in that household feels heard and valued. So, okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it.
Because whether you are navigating this in your own home, or maybe you're supporting a friend who is, or you know, you're just insanely curious about human relationships, this deep dive is going to give you some profound aha moments.
I completely agree.
But to solve this family balance equation, I think we first have to honestly examine what it actually feels like to be in the siblings' shoes.
Yeah, and to do that, we really have to discard the idea that there is a single monolithic, sibling experience.
Right. There's no one size fits all here.
No, not at all. The guide points out that family dynamics are shaped by this really volatile mix of variables. We're talking about the age gaps between the children, whether the non-autistic sibling is the firstborn.
Oh, birth order is huge.
Huge. And the overall size of the family. And crucially, the specific level of autism the child has. I mean, a neurotypical teenager with a non-speaking autistic toddler is living a completely different reality than, say, a 7-year-old whose older autistic brother requires low support.
Right. And it's not a static environment either. The source material highlights how external life cycle changes just severely impact the home.
Oh, yeah. The moving targets.
Exactly. It's not just the day-to-day routine, it's what happens when the neurotypical sibling hits puberty, right? Or when they transition to middle school.
Those are massive disruptions.
They are. Those standard coming-of-age milestones can completely upend whatever fragile balance a family has managed to build,
Right.
because suddenly the siblings' needs are shifting wildly.
Every single developmental change introduces new stressors, and those stressors, they bring out an incredibly complex mix of emotions in the neurotypical siblings.
A really messy mix.
Very messy. The guide lists these out, and we really need to look at the psychology behind them. So, on the positive side, you see deep protectiveness, an incredible willingness to sacrifice their own needs, and, really close friendship bonds.
Which is beautiful to see.
It is. But weighed against that, you have profound fatigue, public embarrassment, and even behaviors like shunning or outright spitefulness toward their autistic sibling.
It sounds a bit like a solar system.
Oh, how so?
Well, if one planet has an incredibly strong gravitational pull, it inevitably alters the orbit of everything else in the house, you know?
That's a great way to look at it.
Every other child has to constantly adjust their trajectory just to avoid a collision or just to stay in the system at all.
Yeah, they're constantly realigning.
But looking at that list of negative emotions, the shunning, the spitefulness, the embarrassment, I kind of have to push back a little here.
Okay, go ahead.
Are parents supposed to just accept those negative emotions as normal without feeling completely consumed by guilt? I mean, it seems like an impossible emotional load to carry as a mom or a dad.
Well, what's fascinating here is that trying to suppress those negative emotions is actually the most counterproductive thing a parent can do.
Really, suppressing it makes it worse.
Absolutely. The guide is very clear that these complex, messy experiences are exactly what build resilience in siblings. But, and this is key, only provided the challenges are recognized rather than ignored.
Okay, so naming it is important.
Right. We have to look at why a sibling resorts to spitefulness. In a household that's dominated by high needs care, extreme behavior often becomes the only currency that buys parental attention.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. When a child acts out with spite or they express embarrassment, they aren't being malicious. They are broadcasting a distress signal.
They're essentially saying, like, I'm drowning over here and I need you to notice me.
Exactly. And if a parent panics, you know, and shames them for that distress signal, the child's guilt just compounds and they bury it.
Which is a recipe for long-term resentment.
Completely. But if the parent accepts that feeling exhausted or embarrassed is a totally logical human reaction to a highly stressful, gravity-shifting environment, they can actually help the child process it.
But just recognizing the emotion doesn't fix the dynamic, right? I mean, you can't just nod at a spiteful kid and move on.
Right. Acknowledging it is only step one.
So how do parents actually de-escalate these feelings before they, like, calcify into permanent resentment?
Well, that brings us to the environmental shifts the guide recommends. And it starts with creating open communication opportunities where siblings can express those messy emotions without any judgment whatsoever.
So a totally safe space.
Yes. And it explicitly says families need to dissect the really difficult scenarios openly.
Like what kind of scenarios?
Take a massive meltdown at the grocery store, for example. You can't just drive home in silence, sweep it under the rug, and pretend it was a normal Tuesday. Kids know when the air in the room has changed.
Oh, absolutely. They absorb the tension, but they don't have the context.
Exactly. They feel the stress, but they might completely lack the vocabulary to understand exactly what's happening or why they feel so angry that their grocery trip was ruined.
So what should a parent say in that car ride?
The guide advises parents to just sit down and say, "That was really loud and scary today, and it's okay if you feel mad that we had to leave early."
Wow. Just calling it out.
Yeah. You give them permission to feel the loss of their own normal experience.
Now I have to pause you there.
Sure.
Because if I'm an exhausted parent listening to this right now, the source's next piece of advice, which is finding, you know, distraction-free, one-on-one special time with each child.
Right. The special time.
Yeah. It just sounds like another exhausting chore on my endless to-do list. When you are already managing a high-needs household, how does a parent realistically carve out this magical one-on-one time?
I get that. And the source material actually anticipates that exact exhaustion.
Okay.
It really emphasizes that this doesn't have to be a grand cinematic outing to an amusement park. It can be incredibly low stakes.
Mm. What does low stakes look like?
The guide suggests just reading a single book together or going for a 10-minute walk around the block, maybe playing a quick card game. The critical element isn't the scale of the activity, it's the undivided attention.
So it's the distraction-free part that does all the heavy lifting.
Exactly.
The phone is away, the mental load is officially paused, and the parent is just present.
Just present. That 10 minutes of pure presence actively prevents sibling resentment because it reinforces the parent-child bond completely outside the context of the autistic sibling's needs.
Which they desperately need.
Right. And the guide suggests keeping this time mostly light and fun, but using it as sort of a safe container.
A container for what exactly?
For conversation. When you're just walking around the block shoulder to shoulder, it removes the intensity of a face-to-face interrogation. It acts as a pressure valve, making it much easier to casually just ask, "Hey, how are you handling things lately?"
Okay, so we have the environment set up. We're taking the walks. We're opening the door for communication.
Right.
But even if a child feels safe enough to say, "I'm furious that he ruined my Lego set," the parent still has to bridge that gap in understanding.
Yes, they do.
How do they explain why the autistic sibling behaves so differently without it just sounding like an excuse?
That requires translating the autistic child's experience into terms the sibling can actually grasp. And the guide points out this must be carefully calibrated to the sibling's age.
Because you're not going to talk to a kindergartner like a teenager.
Obviously not. You aren't going to give a five-year-old a clinical breakdown of neurology.
Right.
For a five-year-old, you might explain that their brother's brain works like a different kind of computer, and sometimes it just gets too many pop-up windows at once.
Oh, I love that. Pop-up windows.
Yeah, it makes sense to them. But for a 12-year-old, you can actually discuss sensory gating issues and neurological overload.
Here's where it gets really interesting for me. It's like handing the neurotypical sibling a translation dictionary.
That's a great way to put it.
You're giving them the literal tools to decode a language they've been watching their whole lives but just never fully understood.
Exactly.
The guide specifically mentions explaining common behaviors, right? Like sensory sensitivities, communication differences, strong preference for routines, and struggles with emotional regulation.
That translation dictionary analogy captures the mechanism perfectly. I mean, think about a scenario where an autistic child covers their ears and starts screaming in a crowded restaurant.
Okay.
To a neurotypical sibling, without that dictionary, it just looks like a tantrum. It looks like bad behavior that is selfishly ruining the family dinner.
Right. It looks intentional.
But if you've explained sensory sensitivities, if they understand that the fluorescent lights are physically hurting their sibling's eyes and the chatter sounds like a jet engine inside their head, the sibling's perception fundamentally shifts.
To help build that dictionary, the guide recommends using books and videos to make these abstract concepts tangible.
Yes, visual aids are huge.
But they include a really crucial caveat. You have to reinforce that every autistic child is unique. Just because they watch a video about an autistic character who loves trains doesn't mean their sister's going to react the exact same way.
Right. It's not a monolith.
It's about building a tailored understanding of their specific household.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, this education isn't just about sharing medical facts. It's about cultivating profound empathy.
Which changes everything.
It does. When you choose content that promotes empathy, you're giving the non-autistic sibling the cognitive framework to react logically rather than emotionally during triggering situations.
So they don't just react with anger.
Exactly. Instead of getting furious when their sibling destroys a game due to a broken routine, they understand the underlying anxiety that's causing the explosion. They stop taking the chaotic behavior as a personal attack.
Which is an incredible level of maturity for a kid.
It really is.
But doesn't that present a totally different problem?
What do you mean?
Well, once a sibling truly empathizes with their autistic brother or sister, and they understand all the triggers, wouldn't the natural instinct be to step in and try to manage it themselves? Like they might start trying to absorb the stress to protect their parents.
Oh, wow. You've just identified the caregiver trap.
The caregiver trap?
Yes. The guide is incredibly firm on this boundary. When siblings become overly empathetic, they often sacrifice their own childhoods to become a third parent.
Oh, that makes so much sense. No. And that's not fair to them at all.
Not at all. To counter this, the source stresses the importance of celebrating individual strengths, talents, and milestones without making any comparisons. Let them have their own distinct identity.
Right.
And it brings up a very specific strategy. Avoiding competitive language and even avoiding competitive games to a certain extent.
Okay, wait. I have to ask a pointed question about that.
Go for it.
I get avoiding comparisons totally. But why avoid competitive games entirely? Isn't playing Monopoly or racing in the backyard a normal part of sibling life? Isn't that how kids learn how to win and lose gracefully?
In a typical household, competition is absolutely a standard developmental tool. But we have to look at the mechanics of why the source material advises against it here.
Okay, lay it out for me.
In a home where one child requires immense support, the playing field is inherently unequal. If you force competition, you are highlighting the deficits of the autistic child.
Oh, I see.
Even worse, you are putting the neurotypical child in a terrible psychological bind. If they win, their success might trigger a severe meltdown in their sibling, which then requires parental intervention and just ruins the afternoon.
Oh, wow. So the concept of winning actually becomes a source of extreme anxiety for the neurotypical sibling rather than a source of pride.
Exactly.
They learn just to shrink themselves to keep the peace.
And that breeds deep, invisible resentment on both sides. The goal, as the guide lays out, is to let each child shine on their own merits so they feel equally valued. You want parallel success, not competitive success.
Parallel success. I like that.
The neurotypical sibling needs spaces where they can excel without the fear that their achievement is going to cause a crisis at home.
That completely reframes the entire concept of family game night.
It really does.
And that ties directly into the hardest boundary the guide sets. Siblings should never be put in the position of caregivers. Putting their needs second cannot become a pattern.
It just can't.
The guide explicitly says to keep siblings out of stressful events like meltdowns or safety situations to avoid burdening them with responsibility or guilt.
Now, siblings can absolutely be part of an overarching autism safety plan if they are age appropriate.
Okay, so they can have a role.
Yes. They might need to know how to double check that the front door is locked or, you know which neighbor to call in an absolute emergency.
Right, basic safety.
But their role must be strictly defined as brothers and sisters, not caretakers. When a severe meltdown happens, their job is to go to their room, put on headphones, and just be a kid.
Just step away.
Yes. Yeah. It is not their job to help physically manage the crisis.
which sounds absolutely essential for protecting their mental health. But let's look at the reality of the situation for a second.
Okay.
If the siblings are told to step back during intense safety situations, like an autistic child attempting to wander out of the house,
yeah,
how do the parents manage those crises without falling apart?
That's the million-dollar question.
Right. Parents only have two hands if they are spread dangerously thin. Telling the neurotypical kid to just go read a book feels almost impossible in the heat of the moment.
And this is where the guide pivots from internal family dynamics to the absolute necessity of an external safety net.
You need backup.
You cannot manage a high needs household in a vacuum relying on sheer willpower. First, it means knowing when to call in human experts.
Like therapists.
Exactly. The guide tells parents to look for behavioral markers. Ongoing anxiety, sadness, unexplained anger, or social difficulties in the neurotypical siblings.
So if you're seeing those signs...
If you see those markers, it's time to look at professional options. Private or school counseling, sibling support groups, family therapists, or psychiatrists.
There is zero shame in bringing in professional backup.
None at all.
But the safety net isn't just human, right? It's also technological. Because the source material is from AngelSense, they dive heavily into the role of specialized tools, specifically highlighting their wearable GPS tracker and communication device.
Right, and we really need to look at the mechanics of how that technology actually functions to relieve the pressure you were just talking about.
How does it act like a safety net?
Well, the guide details features like AI-based assistive technology, real-time location tracking, and wandering alerts. The AI actually learns the autistic child's daily routines and transit routes.
Wait, really? It learns their route?
Yeah. So if the school bus takes a strange detour, or if the child wanders beyond the boundary of the playground, the system flags the anomaly and alerts the parent immediately, before a tragedy can unfold.
That's incredible.
It also features an auto-answer speakerphone, meaning the parent can talk to the child and give them calming instructions, even if the child is unable to press a button to answer a call.
You know, what strikes me here is that this technology plays a massive psychological role in the family dynamics, not just a practical one.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes, practically it prevents a wandering crisis. But psychologically, the peace of mind for the parents inevitably trickles down.
The whole vibe of the house changes.
Right. If a parent isn't forced to operate at a level 10, panic, hypervigilant about every unlocked door, the whole house exhales. Mm-hmm. The ambient stress that the siblings absorb is dramatically reduced.
This raises an important question about how we view modern parenting in neurodivergent households.
How so?
We often think of assistive technology as a tool strictly for the autistic individual. We view it in a silo. But tools like AngelSense actually function as a structural support beam for the entire family ecosystem.
A structural support beam. That's a powerful image.
By absorbing that intense, hypervigilant caretaking stress, the technology essentially acts as that extra set of hands you mentioned earlier.
So the neurotypical sibling doesn't have to be the extra hands.
Exactly. It grants the autistic child greater everyday independence safely, and by doing so, it lowers the temperature of the entire house. That lower temperature is precisely what gives the non-autistic siblings the freedom to step back and just be kids.
So what does this all mean? Let me just pull this together, because when we pull back and look at this entire AngelSense guide, a few core takeaways really crystallize.
They do.
First, we have to stop trying to force an unnatural equilibrium, right? And instead validate the messy, turbulent emotions of the siblings without guilt or shame.
Let them be messy.
Second, parents absolutely must carve out that simple, distraction-free time to protect their individual bond with each child, even if it's just 10 minutes a day.
To walk around the block.
Exactly. We need to build empathy through education, handing them that translation dictionary so they understand the why behind the behavior.
Empathy, not caretaking.
Right, because we have to fiercely protect the siblings' right to their own childhood, keeping them out of that caregiver trap. And finally, families need to lean heavily on their safety net, using both professionals and technology to absorb the stress that no single human can carry alone.
It is a comprehensive blueprint for intentional, sustainable balance.
It really is. And for you listening right now, I want you to consider how these dynamics play out in your own life. Even if autism isn't a factor in your household, how do you manage the balance of attention in your relationships?
It's a great question.
How do you make sure the quiet ones in your orbit still feel seen and heard when louder, more urgent issues are demanding all of your energy. I mean, it's a universal human challenge.
It absolutely is. And I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over, drawing on the source's repeated emphasis on resilience.
Okay, let's hear it.
We understandably spend a lot of time worrying about the immense burden placed on these siblings, the fatigue, the emotional toll, the forced maturity.
It's a lot to carry.
But think about the incredible, invisible training ground this experience actually is. If these siblings are guided correctly through all this, if they learn profound empathy for those who communicate differently, if they learn healthy boundary setting, and if they master complex emotional regulation from a very young age.
Wow.
Right? What kind of remarkably compassionate leaders, partners, and friends are they going to become 20 years down the road?
That is an incredibly powerful way to look at it. They aren't just surviving the gravitational pull of their environment. They're learning how to navigate the whole universe with grace.
Perfectly said.
We are out of time for today's deep dive, but thank you for joining us. Keep exploring, keep asking questions, and remember to check in on the quiet planets in your own solar system. We'll catch you next time.